Hi everyone, I'm Josh, and this is The Emerald, Currents and Trends Through a Mythic Lens, the podcast where we explore an ever-changing world and our lives in it through the lens of myth, story, and imagination. The Emerald, all that's happening on this green jewel in space. If you're of a certain age, then you definitely saw these ads. For Geico, the insurance company, before they switched to their trademark lizard, the ads featured a trio of hipster bachelor cavemen who are constantly encountering what I guess you could call anti-caveman bias. So easy a caveman could do it, the voices around them blared, and the protagonist paleolists would roll their eyes or storm out of fancy luncheons or stew bitterly over their roast duck with mango salsa, encountering yet again humanity's prejudice towards our ancient ancestors. The ads were funny mostly because of the sight of the cavemen, who were definitely made up to look like stereotypical cavemen, which of course cavemen didn't actually look like. Hairy, exaggerated brows, but wearing tennis whites and dapper suits. But beneath the funny was the tacit acknowledgement of something else, which I'm sure Geico didn't think much about, but is actually very real. Our assumptions that our ancestors were primitive. You know, that they were dumb, that they were somehow less than us. Bias against the Paleolithic peoples who literally form 97% of our ancestry. And I say it a lot on this podcast, and I'm going to let 97% sink in a little bit this time. 97% of our ancestry. This bias is very, very real, and it has a deep effect on how we view the world, and how we sit as a society within place and time. Contrast the common modern Western vision of the caveman with this. Millions of years ago, say the Puranic texts of India, was the Satya Yuga, which is also sometimes called the Krita Yuga, or the Golden Age. People who lived during this time didn't need to grow crops to survive, as the earth freely provided its bounty. They didn't know warfare, treating each other with inherent love and kindness. They lived lifespans of tens of thousands of years and radiated health and vitality. There were no religious sects or societal infighting, and people lived connected to the divine source, without the need for priests or religious arbiters. In fact, if this age of humankind could be summarized by a cow, that cow would be healthy, golden, radiant, and have four strong, sturdy legs. So yeah, you could chalk this up as a nice story, except for the fact that culture upon culture around the world holds this same vision, that our ancestors were actually more attuned, more developed, more powerful, more intelligent than we are. In the Australian Aboriginal mind, the ancestors were creators, weaving the geography of the world together through a network of song lines that are now embedded in place and in family line. The journey through a landscape is a living journey through ancestral lineage. Many Polynesian cultures kept their ancestors alive and approachable in the form of stones. Stones that they would tell you, as they told one British skeptic explorer in the wonderful book The Sea People, were not representations of ancestors, but were the ancestors themselves. Ancestor worship plays a massive role in the traditions of China and Southeast Asia and in sub-Saharan Africa, where in the Congolese traditions the ancestors are reawakened as effigies that become literal, material companions for the shaman or sorcerer. So people literally walk through life carrying their ancestors. These little effigies draped in cowrie shells and iron nails and hair that are wakened through ritual and are the ancestor, feeding them, interacting with them, having conversations with them as present living being. How does it shift our perspective to imagine our ancestors literally walking with us as we move through life? Look, ancestor, I'm walking the paths that you walk, singing the songs that you sang, dreaming the dreams that you dreamed. The point here isn't to say that our ancient ancestors were better than us on some arbitrary scale of better or worse. I also don't believe in over-glamorizing the past. Our ancestors fought and farted just like we do. But it is valuable to shake up our unconscious bias a little bit. In a pervasive cultural worldview of a progression from primitive to advanced, there would be little I could say that would counterbalance the hundreds of years of very real vilification, derision, prejudice, sarcasm, dismissal, and overall void of understanding leveled towards our deep ancestors. Trust me, we don't have to worry about over-glamorizing. We need to start to unpack just how deep our ancestral bias goes. For example, and I'm asking you to check this out really deeply, because I guarantee these attitudes are there because they're there in me too. Whether consciously or not, we assume that Paleolithic people lived in a world that was fundamentally less because they didn't yet have what we have. We assume that really their existence was incomplete because it hadn't yet culminated in us. They were stepping stones, naturally, on the way to being us. What else would they be? This attitude of ancestor bias in the Western world begins possibly in ancient Greece, but definitely with woefully misguided Christian narratives about the age of the world being 5,000 years old. It reaches its culmination in Victorian visions of progress. When Victorian explorers encountered cultures that lived vastly different lives than they did, it deeply shook them. They had to fit it all into a worldview, and that worldview, of course, had to be based ultimately in the superiority of Victorian man. Or how could they justify eradicating or submitting these cultures to colonial rule? So everything, the entire process of evolution, existed to eventually produce Victorian man. Bad teeth, mutton chops, and all. The pinnacle of existence. Quite a different vision than the radiant beings of the Satya Yuga. It goes deeper. We assume, unconsciously, that the depth and range of Paleolithic people's love for one another must have been somehow less than ours, their relationships less textured, their conversations less nuanced, the depth of their experience not so deep as ours, their sex, as it is often portrayed, bordering nearly always on rape. You know the thread, caveman courtship, clubbing a potential partner and dragging her off to your cave. Or that old Daryl Hannah movie, Clan of the Cave Bear, in which the caveman singles out a desired mate, makes a hand signal, and the woman is required to get on all fours and submit right then and there. Now, I'm not saying that Paleolithic courtship bore any resemblance to what we call courtship today, nor am I saying that whatever sense of romantic love existed back then is similar to our sense of romantic love today either. All I'm saying is that there's absolutely no reason to believe that it was chaos, or random, or violent. Hunter-gatherer societies today, for example, have some of the most intricate rituals around wedding, so there's no reason to believe that Paleolithic society was any less ordered. But for whatever reason, we tend to think of it as chaos. Well, that's an example of a pretty deep bias. In seeing a full 97% of our ancestors this way, we have erased our ancestors from being an active presence in our lives today. The notion of thousands of generations of rich ancestral vision, fathers whose feet crunched through wet snow and who kissed the soft spot on their sons' heads, mothers who felt the nectar of trance rise in their skulls in the ritual dances, lovers who stole away to lie in warm furs beneath the starlight, kayakers who saw devouring goddesses in the far lights of the aurora, escapes us. Generations and generations of tales and stories that wove and interwove into deep tapestries of knowledge, methods of navigating forests and landscapes with such deep awareness and textures and nuance, plant knowledge that has never been equaled. So what's the big deal, you might ask? Sure, we don't give them much thought, but our ancestors are long gone. What does it really matter how we see them now? Well, I'm saying that ancestor bias has real-world effect. It affects us today to dismiss our ancestors of yesterday, and the narratives we tell about the past affect what is possible for our future. Nowhere is this more clear than in how we view conflict, violence, and war. We take it for granted that warfare and large-scale societal violence is how it's always been. Well, there's a whole lot of evidence these days, and I mean a whole lot, which we'll get into, that it's not actually how it's always been. And when we assume it is, then we make it less possible for there to be anything else. We make a future with less violence, a future with, remember this word, peace, seem further and further away. And when we unwittingly dismiss the deep textures of the ancestral mind as primitive, when we forget or reframe certain key ways that our ancestors had of experiencing this world and cosmos, the states of mind and consciousness that they valued, then there is less possible for our minds to be now. We sentence ourselves to a future that is already written, a on the assumptions that a mind steeped in the culture of postmodern capitalism and the narrative of technological progress is the only mind worth having. Well, the ancestral mind was much more variegated than this. It had to be. Today on the podcast, let's blow some cobwebs off of the ancestral mind and heart. Let's imagine our ancestors, wake them up, give them texture, feel their lives. Start to do so, and you can almost start to feel a change in the movement of the air. Start to do so, and the possible seems to stir. Reimagining our ancestors, a dive into the Paleolithic heart and mind, today on the Emerald. She ate a meal of duck and berries. She was chewing on birch sap the way we chew on gum. It was the birch sap, in fact, that yielded all these treasures of information about her. 5,700 years ago, a girl in Sweden spat out her gum with a little bit of her saliva embedded into it. And all these centuries later, we get to peer through the looking glass of time into her life a little bit. She had dark skin. It was a Scandinavia at that time populated by people with dark skin and blue eyes. Imagine that. If she gave birth and her genetic line continued, and a few of her offspring along the way had the fortune of more than one child who also gave birth to more than one child, then it's quite possible that literally millions of people alive on the planet today can call her grandmother. Millions. I'm feeling a lot in relation to ancestry these days, because I've got an 8-month-old son. When he looks at me and his fingers reach for my hand, I imagine generation upon generation upon generation of son's fingers reaching for father's hands. Thousands of generations, going back 200,000 years or more. It's hard to wrap our mind around timescales in the hundreds of thousands of years, so let's think of it this way. Let's take science's current figure of 200,000 years ago as the emergence of anatomically modern humans. And mind you, this is a number that will almost certainly be pushed back, as it continually has been in my lifetime alone. When I was in high school, the number was around 20,000 years. It's now 10 times greater. Who knows how much further it'll go the more we sift through deeper and deeper dirt. But for now, let's use 200,000 as the number of years ago when anatomically modern humans emerged from an even deeper line of ancestry that recedes far into the prehistoric twilight. These humans are people just like you and me, with the exact same brains and bones, the same intelligence, the same awe at the night sky and drive to understand why, the same vocal cords, the same nimble fingers, the same goosebumps at the dawning of a new idea. The same capacity for feeling and love, 200,000 years. The implications of this number are staggering. It means that 95% of the human experience took place before planted crops. It means 97% of human history happened before the Bronze Age. It means that if you were to chart your direct line of maternal ancestors on a graph, you would have about 100 mothers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers who have lived since the rise of ancient Greece, since the writing of the Vedas, enough to fill a modest-sized hotel conference room. And before that, your direct line of mothers dating back into the long dawn, your line of mothers who never used a written word, there are over 8,000 of them. Enough to sell out the Greek theater in Berkeley, and what a colorful gathering it would be. 8,000 generations. The rule and not the exception. And you've heard me say this enough on this podcast. I don't want you to start to get numb to it. When I say Paleolithic peoples, I mean people who rubbed their hands against the bark of trees and smelled the butterscotch scent of Ponderosa, and listened closely to the wind and the waters breaking on the shoals, and undoubtedly sang, and undoubtedly wept, and undoubtedly felt with all the range of feeling that we still feel today, and undoubtedly made what we now call art, and undoubtedly had as rich of an experience of life and cosmos and each other and the human story as we do, maybe in some ways richer. ¶¶ So yeah, I've been raising my 8-month-old and thinking about ancestry. I've also been watching this show called The Last Kingdom on Netflix. It's about the era of King Alfred the Great in England. And like many shows, it's set in a time period when human beings spent a whole lot of time chopping each other into little bits. Television now seems to love this phase of human history, the ransacking phase. If you watch The Last Kingdom, or Vikings, or Game of Thrones, or Rome, or Spartacus, or the list goes on, it would be easy to conclude that human history is basically a carnival of rape and carnage and struggles for dominance and sacking castles and fortresses and weeping women and grunting men and bare-knuckle cage fighting and beer and meat and mayhem. If you listen to Dan Carlin podcasts, and I do, and I love his depth of knowledge and his delivery, but if you listen to hardcore history and you hear the history of human intensity and violence relayed in such detail, you might conclude that this is just the way things are. Dan's even fond of saying this, the way it was in the ancient world. You know, go back a couple thousand years, and the Romans and Greeks, they were brutal too. And before them, the Sumerians, who left us a horror show of art depicting their draconian system of justice. And yeah, they were big fans of flaying people alive. So imagine if you went back even further, it must have been chaos. It must have been bones crushing skulls and women being dragged off by the hair and a brute struggle for survival. Nasty, brutish, and short, as the saying goes. Except, if the newest archaeological findings are to be believed, it kind of wasn't. Studies on existent hunter-gatherer cultures show that they make war on each other with far less frequency than their agricultural cousins, and in many instances, they don't make war at all. From Scientific American, quote, "A study by anthropologists Douglas Fry and Patrick Soderberg found scant evidence of warfare among 21 modern-era hunter-gatherer societies on 5 continents. 3 of the societies had no observed killings of any kind, and 10 had no killings carried out by more than one perpetrator. A single society, the Tiwi of Australia, accounted for almost all of these group killings. Their findings, Fry and Soderberg concluded, contradict assertions that mobile foragers engaged in coalitionary war against other groups." End quote. And this research is consistent with what we found out about our hunter-gatherer ancestors as well. A lot of people like to quote those studies that say that you or I are much less likely to die a violent death than a person in the 1600s. That makes us feel good about ourselves, you know, like things are getting a lot better. Yeah, that statistic has a problem, though. It only goes back 1,000 years or so. It relies on information that we have from the ransacking phase, that period of human history in which war was everyone's favorite pastime. And before that, back into the long dawn of human history, we don't find evidence to show that we were spending a lot of time and effort killing each other. The ransacking phase is recent. Quote, "Anthropologists Jonathan Haas and Matthew Pistelli have carried out an exhaustive review of hominid remains over 10,000 years old, including more than 2,900 skeletons from over 400 different sites. Haas and Pistelli found only 4 skeletons bearing signs of violence. That's the examination of 3,000 skeletons, and 4 died violent deaths." The writers go on to conclude, quote, "The evidence is overwhelming that war, far from being an innate behavior that evolved millions of years ago, was a cultural innovation, an invention, as Margaret Mead put it, that emerged relatively recently in our prehistory. But of course, we always assume that war is just the way it is, simply because it's just the way we are. Contrast these recent findings with the vision of war in nature in the 1651 book Leviathan. In Leviathan, Thomas Hobbes speaks of war of every one against the other, and a perpetual war of every man against his neighbor. Quote, "I demonstrate in the first place that the state of men without civil society, which state we may properly call the state of nature, is nothing else but a mere war of all against all, and in that war all men have equal right unto all things." Welcome to the civilized view. When I was a kid, a book called Lord of the Flies was on pretty much every middle school kid's reading list. It told the cautionary tale of what happens when human beings fall too deeply under the spell of nature. A group of British boarding school students are marooned on a deserted island and try at first to maintain decorum and order, but gradually descend into primitivism and violence. Their hair grows long, all that is except the civilized protagonist who is somehow immune from the evils of hair growth, and they start putting on face paint, and pretty soon they're all killing each other and worshipping decapitated pigs, which, of course, is what happens when we spend too much time in nature. The message is clear. Revert to nature, and that means primitivism and violence. I can only hope that book is no longer being taught in schools. I mean, in the 80s, it was pretty torturous what they made kids read. Like, who makes a kid read Old Yeller? Seriously, it's like torture. I mean, who does that? But yeah, Lord of the Flies is trash. Because now we can pretty safely say that the opposite is true. That cultures that are closest to nature, foragers, are far less likely to be violent. The research goes on and on. Quote, skeletal and artifactual evidence of intergroup violence between Paleolithic nomadic foragers is absent as well. And, quote, of the many cave paintings of the Upper Paleolithic, none depicts people attacking other people explicitly. Which is saying something, because once you get into Sumerian, Greek, Roman, and medieval cultures, you get lots and lots and lots of elaborate frescoes depicting people skewering each other, hacking each other to bits, boiling each other alive, running each other through. But for 95% of our history, no one thought that was an important enough matter to depict in art. Look, I'm not going to tell you that Paleolithic people were absent of human problems, that they were all pacifist navel-gazers living in some utopian society that never fought. I'm not going to give you the Marie Gimbutas narrative that prehistoric goddess cultures were all fine and good until the patriarchs of the Russian steppe stormed down and changed everything. That view has its problems, too. But let's also say that some of the archaeologists and anthropologists who derided Gimbutas for her goddess-forward vision of history have come around a little bit, to the point that at least one of them publicly apologized to her. Because, as wrapped up as her work was in forwarding a particular agenda, just like all of our work is, supposedly objective people included, she pointed to something that is now pretty well verified. The big shift in humanity's history came with agriculture. Quote, some scholars believe that the period of Paleolithic warlessness persisted until well after the appearance of Homo sapiens some 315,000 years ago, ending only at the occurrence of economic and social shifts associated with sedentism, when new conditions incentivized organized raiding of settlements. Yep, what changed everything was agriculture. Because for the first time, after we began growing things and storing things, we had stuff. Yuval Harari, in his brilliant book Sapiens, calls agriculture the biggest fraud in human history. Quote, foragers knew the secrets of nature long before the agricultural revolution, since their survival depended on an intimate knowledge of the animals they hunted and the plants they gathered. Rather than heralding a new era of easy living, the agricultural revolution left farmers with lives generally more difficult and less satisfying than those of foragers. Hunter-gatherers spent their time in more stimulating and varied ways and were less in danger of starvation and disease. The agricultural revolution certainly enlarged the sum total of food at the disposal of humankind, but the extra food did not translate into a better diet or more leisure. Rather, it translated into population explosions and pampered elites. The average farmer worked harder than the average forager and got a worse diet in return. The agricultural revolution was history's biggest fraud. The biggest fraud because we assume that agriculture was a great step forward on the road to progress. History is a line, right? And that line starts out really primitive. And then there's fire, and we're a little more advanced. And then there's agriculture, and we're a little more advanced. And then there's the Industrial Revolution, and we're a little more advanced. And now there's Amazon, where you can buy books like Old Yeller and traumatize your children. And now there's Walmart, and so yeah, we must be really advanced. Contrast that with what Harari says. Life in the city of Jericho 8,000 years ago was far more difficult than life 9,000 years ago or 13,000 years ago. Well, wait a minute. That changes the narrative a little bit. How could it have been harder? I thought agriculture was a big step on the road to convenience. So yeah, what he means is that for all our talk of convenience and the leisure time that comes with agriculture, the truth is a little different. And the truth was rather uncomfortable for Victorian man, remember him? Because the truth might have suggested that he wasn't actually the pinnacle of the world that he thought he was. Jason Gadeski, a writer and member of the rewilding group, the Tribe of Anthropic, says this. As the theory of evolution began to take hold, many Victorian anthropologists speculated on the role hunting and gathering played in humanity's steady, inevitable ascent from backwards primitivism to the obvious evolutionary ideal of the Victorian gentleman. They wrote about the difficult, dangerous, and marginal lives that hunter-gatherers led. With the invention of agriculture, the story goes, hunter-gatherers had time for leisure for the first time, and with it they could begin to produce things they never had before, like philosophy, art, medicine, and science. With this increased leisure time, hunter-gatherers were able to rise up out of savagery and begin their ascent to civilization. And this is the quote continuing. Despite the apparent contradiction between this idea that hunter-gatherers had to toil constantly just to stay alive and the stereotype of lazy savages, no one bothered to actually measure how much time hunter-gatherers have to devote to work until 1948. F.D. McCarthy and M. MacArthur's study with four different groups in Arnhem Land, published over a decade later in 1960, suffered from a number of methodological problems, but they suggested the shocking possibility that foragers might actually work less than agricultural or industrial people, and have more, not less, leisure time. Between October 1963 and January 1965, Richard Borche Lee conducted fieldwork with the Kung Bushmen in the Dobe area of Botswana. In all, the adults of the Dobe camp worked about 2.5 days a week. Since the average working day was about 6 hours long, the fact emerges that Kung Bushmen of Dobe, despite their harsh environment, devote from 12 to 19 hours a week getting food. And that 12 to 19 hours was not necessarily seen as work as we think of it either. As Boston College PhD Peter Gray says, quote, "In general, hunter-gatherers do not have a concept of toil. When they do have that concept, it derives apparently from their contact with outsiders. They may learn a word for toil to refer to the work of their neighboring farmers, miners, or road construction workers, but they do not apply it to their own work." So, when we begin to invert the progress narrative, we start to realize that we've not done our distant ancestors justice. We've assumed them to be dumb, lacking, stepping stones on the way to being us. We've assumed their lives were unimaginably difficult. We've assumed that the lack of material objects or lack of written text in the archaeological record implies a similar paucity of experience. We look at a life devoid of objects, and we assume that means a life devoid of meaning. We assume that because they had less, they were less. Let's look deeper at that equation about having less. I'm going to suggest that the opposite is true. I suggest that when you have less material distraction, the mind is free to explore itself in greater detail. And so a culture without material distraction may find great value in states of mind and textures of consciousness. And this gets into deep territory about what is actually precious in this world. Myself, I spent a lot of time as a child in what you can call undistracted space. I sat in a pretty sparse room, alone, while my parents did extensive meditation sessions. I had art supplies and a room to myself. No TVs, no screens, no phones, no distractions. Before you get up in arms and call Child Protective Services 40 years later, I consider those times of undistracted space some of the most fruitful of my life. My inner world leapt to life. I can tell you the languages I invented and the scenes I drew and the rosters of the imaginary sports teams I created, all in my mind. These days, if you'll indulge me in a kids these days moment, there is rarely 1 minute of the day that people spend in undistracted space. Well, imagine the difference if there were no distractions. The Dalai Lama has spoken at length about what it means for a culture to be materially poor but spiritually rich. The Paleolithic dawn of human history speaks to hundreds of thousands of years of ritualized interaction with nature and mind, without the distraction of material objects. Simply put, this much naked beholding of world and mind could have been nothing but deeply profound. So right, invert the progress narrative, and we start to see that not only were our ancestors stronger than us, the average woman as strong as a modern-day Olympic rower, one study showed, more attuned to the natural world than us, they quite possibly knew the playing field of consciousness much more intimately than we do. Those Indian texts about the golden age of our ancestors are starting to sound a lot more true. Anthropologists like Yuval Harari and Felipe Fernandez Armesto have made great strides in helping us rethink the primitive moniker that we've attached to our early ancestors. They're both great writers, and they've written great books that fill out our understandings of early human beings. Yet there's one area where they, too, fall into a culturally myopic trap when thinking about the ancestral mind. They both speak about how it was a great leap forward in human thought and cognition for human beings to start to be able to depict in art and imagine through religion things that, quote, didn't really exist. Here's Yuval Harari speaking of the Löwenmensch of Stadel, a carved lion-headed figurine from 32,000 years ago, quote, "This is one of the first indisputable examples of art, and probably of religion, and of the human mind to imagine things that do not really exist." And here's Felipe Fernandez Armesto describing the ancients' ability to move past the five senses and believe in something that existed beyond their senses, as he says. Quote, "Once the discoveries of unseen worlds began to subvert assumptions derived from sense perception, and to suspect that sensed data may be illusory, they, early man, became philosophers. To mistrust the senses in favor of reliance on imaginative gifts was dangerous but alluring. The idea of illusion freed minds to discover or guess that there are invisible, inaudible, untouchable, because immaterial, realities, inaccessible to the senses but attainable to humans by other means. To ascribe lively actions to spirits is probably false, but not crude or superstitious. Rather, it is an inference, albeit not verifiable, from the way the world is." Okay, so Armesto here is partly right. It's not crude or superstitious to believe in the presence of spirits. Where he goes off, and this is just my opinion here, is that he assumes that the presence of spirits was something that they thought up through cognition. Nowhere do either Harari or Armesto acknowledge that early human beings, with their rituals and practices designed specifically to take one into the trance state, and their lifestyles of deprivation and prolonged exercise that were very trance-friendly lifestyles, actually experienced what we now call supernatural forces as real with their five senses. They weren't thinking beyond their senses. They didn't abstractly think these forces up. They felt them. They didn't mentally conjure threads of light and humming stones and rocks as ancestors randomly out of thin air. They experienced them directly. Their senses told them different things than our senses tell us, because we don't access the state of trance in nature with the regularity that they did. Myth is not conjecture, it is felt experience. Native cultures don't use the word supernatural. They also don't use the word animism, which is a modern concept. Our ancestors' interaction with the natural world includes the experience of what we now call unseen forces, because we don't see them. Anthropologist David Lewis Williams spent his career demonstrating that the nature of religious or spiritual experience is not based on thinking things up, but on direct experience felt in the trance state. Take it way back to episode 2 of this podcast, to the people who watch a man grow horns as he's shamanizing. That's not an idea that has something or other to teach us about the human capacity for abstract thought. That's a direct felt experience, a texture of the ancestral mind that is all but lost to us. A few years back, I was training for an ultramarathon. I went for a 20-mile training run at Chaco Canyon in western New Mexico. At mile 16, I hit a wall. I bonked, as some people say. I ran out of glycogen supply. I still had 4 miles to go through sandstone canyons in the midday sun, but I couldn't run. I could barely walk. Every step was agony. I could feel the salt crusting on my face. Above me, sandstone faces with tufts of grassy hair stared at me unflinchingly. I could almost hear their voices. How common do you think an experience like that was for our ancestors? How much of their cosmology was directly sprung from such somatic experience? This is where we have to understand the role that states of consciousness play in history. Our history can be told just as much through states of consciousness as it can through thoughts, ideas, or objects. This is the alternate history of our ancestors, a history of textures, a history of feelings, an ancient hum still alive. So yeah, our ancestors weren't primitive. They were not less than us. They were strong, they were smart. They most likely didn't spend a whole lot of time preoccupied with killing each other until rather recently. They valued trance states and art probably above war, had deep knowledge of the natural world, and in the absence of material stuff, plumbed the depths and heights of human consciousness. Acknowledging them like this leaves us free, of course, to imagine them, to breathe life into their faces. You have a father who walked the world 100,000 years ago. He was 27 once, like you were, or like you'll be. He was an artist, just as you were. An artist, just as you were. It's my belief that to breathe some life into our ancestors can free us from a whole lot of stress in this life over who we are and what we need to get done and what progress really means. Then, collectively, we can ask if human beings are doing right by our ancestors. Did they live and love and struggle and overcome and dance and sing and sweat so we could live the lives we're living now? Are there ways in which we could honor them more? Maybe just by imagining their faces and footsteps, hearing their voices whisper in the wind. This episode contains a whole lot of references, just so you know. I'm not just making up this whole Paleolithic people were peaceful thing. So they are Sapiens by Yuval Harari, Out of Our Minds by Felipe Hernandez Armesto, Clan of the Cave Bear, the 1986 film starring Daryl Hannah, The Sea People by Christina Thompson, The Last Kingdom, a Netflix series, The Nature of the Paleolithic Age by Dale Guthrie, New Study of Prehistoric Skeletons Undermines Claim That War Has Deep Evolutionary Roots by John Horgan in the July 24, 2013 issue of Scientific American, Human Genome Recovered from 5,700-Year-Old Chewing Gum, December 17, 2019 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, War, Peace, and Human Nature by Douglas Fry, The Prehistory of Warfare Misled by Ethnography by Jonathan Haas and Matthew Pistelli, Prehistoric Women Had Stronger Arms Than Modern Athletes, by Nadia Drake in National Geographic, The Evolution of Lethal Intergroup Violence by Raymond Kelly, the work of Maria Gimbutas, including Goddesses and Gods of Old Europe, the writings of Jason Godesky, who's a rewilder, Peter Gray, Boston College on Hunter-Gatherers and Toil, Leviathan by Thomas Hobbes, William Golding's Lord of the Flies, Old Yeller by Fred Gibson, just do yourself a favor and stay away from that one, Dan Carlin's phenomenal podcast series Hardcore History, and of course, Geico's 1990s ad campaign, So Easy a Caveman Could Do It. If you liked what you heard today, please consider becoming a patron. You can find out more at patreon.com/theemeraldpodcast. That's Patreon, patreon.com/theemeraldpodcast. There are patronage levels starting for as low as $6 per month. And patrons get a variety of benefits that are listed on the site. I hope you enjoy today's episode, and until next time, may we live lives that are driven forth by imagination, vision, and wonder.
Seriously, we apologize. We had no idea you guys were still around.
Yeah, next time maybe do a little research.
Gentlemen, are we ready to order?
I'll have the roast duck with the mango salsa.
I don't have much of an appetite, thank you.